Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now to what I expect will be one of our most important interviews of the year here on Open House. About a life, according to my next guest, of such beauty, courage, integrity and authenticity. It's inescapably inspiring, a story that's as eloquent a statement about the meaning of life as anything he could imagine. It's quite a claim. The life is that of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who lived on this earth for just 39 years. He was executed, hanged by the Nazis, in the final days of World War II, and yet he left a vitally important, indelible impression on the Western world, its thinking, and especially Christian thought. Eric Metaxas has undertaken the enormously challenging task of revisiting Bonhoeffer's life and lessons for the world, breaking new ground in his best-selling biography, Bonhoeffer, Pastor, Martyr, Prophet, Spy, A Righteous Gentile versus the Third Reich. For those who've read this book, people with or without Christian faith, they aren't quite the same again. Most of us have heard of Bonhoeffer, many of us know bits of his extraordinary life, but Eric's book is a rich and powerful journey through one of the most significant figures of the last century. It's the first major biography of Bonhoeffer for 40 years, and in a number of ways, he breaks new ground on a story I think we would all do well to absorb deeply into our minds and lives. Eric Metaxas, welcome to Open House.
Wow, what a privilege. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Eric, I think to start with, it's probably going to be important for us to get a glimpse into your own life first, especially why you decided to take on this enormous task, a book that you dedicated to your grandfather.
Yes. Well, it really began the year that I came to faith, which was 1988. I had just been out of college. I went to Yale University, and of course, it's a very secular environment, and I lost what little Christian faith I had and graduated and was quite confused. And just a few years later, in my floundering, trying to be a writer, I took a very menial job, and a believer came into my life, befriended me, and started sharing with me, and this led to me coming to faith very dramatically. In fact, on my website, which I assume I can give out, it's just my name, ericmetaxas.com, but I tell the story. It's an amazing story, and in the course of this summer where I came to faith so dramatically, this friend gave me a copy of Bonhoeffer's Cost of Discipleship and said, have you ever heard of Bonhoeffer? And I said, no, who's Bonhoeffer? And he told me that Bonhoeffer's a German pastor, a man of faith, a Christian who, because of his faith in Jesus, stood up to the Nazis, stood up against Hitler, and stood up for the Jews, and was killed by the Nazis in a concentration camp. And I just couldn't believe it. I will never forget hearing about this and thinking, why haven't I heard this before? Why Yes. doesn't everyone know this tremendous story? Because you hear so many negative stories, at least here in the United States where I live, negative stories about faith. And to hear a story of a man who, because of his faith in Jesus, stood up for the Jews, it was just absolutely extraordinary. And I remember thinking of my grandfather, because my mother is German, my father is Greek. They met in an English class in New York City. And I've grown up with these stories of World War II, and my grandfather was a genuinely reluctant German soldier who was killed in the war. He would listen to the BBC with his ear literally pressed against the radio speaker. And I remember thinking of him and of so many Germans who Bonhoeffer was speaking for them in a way. So it really captured my heart. And it wasn't until many years later that I decided to write about it. I've had a strange career. I've worked for VeggieTales. I'm sure some of your listeners know VeggieTales. And I worked for Chuck Colson, and I've written books of apologetics, children's books. But in one of the apologetics books, I mentioned William Wilberforce, which led someone to ask me to talk about Wilberforce on national TV, on CNN. And that led a publisher to ask me, would you like to write a biography of William Wilberforce? And I'd never thought of writing any biographies in my life, but I wrote the book on William Wilberforce called Amazing Grace and came out with the movie of the same name. And as a result of that, to get to the end here, people kept saying, who will you write about next? Surely now you're a biographer, you've written about Wilberforce, who will be next? And I didn't want to write another biography, but ultimately I thought, I've got to tell one more story of a great hero of the faith, and that is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. As I said, it's a very personal story for me. I had no idea what I was getting into, but I did leap into the fray, and here we are in 2012. I'm glad it's over.
It was only written in 6 months. I'm in awe of that.
Yeah, well, it was, but it's one of those things where if you don't sleep, think about anything else, don't talk to your wife or daughter, and focus like a madman. I mean, I typed 12 plus hours per day, 7 days a week, not taking the Sabbath off. I mean, I don't recommend this way of writing. This is the last thing that I recommend. It was sheer madness, a level of intensity that I don't ever hope to duplicate in my life, God forbid, but it was somehow necessary to get it done, and I did get it done, and I thank the Lord that it's turned out as it turned out.
Yes, it's had an enormous impact already. So, take us into the kind of family, and especially the kind of Germany that Bonhoeffer was born into, Eric.
Well, that's one of the things that really captivated me. I had no idea going into this beyond just the very basics of his life. I didn't know what his family was like. And that was one of the first things that struck me. I said, this man came from a truly amazing family. There's no denying it. Anyone who's read the book knows that this family is singular, just about unique, really. They were, first of all of them brilliant and geniuses. I mean, I've never seen such an accomplished group of people. His father was the most famous psychiatrist in Germany for the first half of the 20th century. So they were legendary figures, and the father, of course, was a very famous figure in Europe during this time. And so Bonhoeffer grows up in this amazing family where everyone is academically ambitious, brilliant, successful, but they were also very kind people. That's what's so interesting, is there was sort of the best of liberal and conservative, the best of Christian and secular. You really saw a kind of an amazing family, and it's no wonder that it produced so many heroes. And of course, Bonhoeffer is the most famous, but his other family members were also very, very brave and tremendous, tremendous during this period with the Nazis.
His mother was a very serious Christian and went on to homeschool her children because of her view about the Germany in which they lived.
Yes, it's very interesting to see the sensitivity. They combined the very best, as I said, of the different sides of German culture. In a typically German way, concerned with right and wrong and what is proper and what is improper. But there was a lot of grace. It wasn't just legalism about right and wrong. There was a lot of grace. And the mother had a sensitivity and understood that homeschooling her children was the way to go. And, of course, she was herself brilliant. She had a teacher's degree. But, yeah, the family, it's hard not to fall in love with the family. It's one of the reasons that I put so much of the family into the book.
Yeah, it's a very important addition. Bonhoeffer himself becomes an outstanding student, a lecturer in systematic theology at Berlin University at 25.
Well, he gets his doctorate. Well, no, even younger. He gets his doctorate in theology at age 21, which is unheard of. And he decides, in the course of answering this high theological question, what is the church, and doing so incredibly brilliantly, he discovers that he has a love for the church itself. He discovers that he also wants to be ordained as a Lutheran pastor. So here you have this guy who's, you know, he could write his own ticket, so to speak, in the world of academic theology, but he also wants to be a pastor. He wants to preach, he wants to teach, he wants to teach Sunday school, he wants to pastor and counsel people. It's a beautiful thing to see this rare combination of gifts, and he could not get ordained until age 25, so he spends a year in Barcelona, Spain, as an assistant vicar at a German-speaking congregation. He then goes to America, and that's really a famous episode. At age 24, 1930, he goes to America, and in a way, that's when it seems to me that his faith goes from his brilliant mind down into his heart, and he becomes a real disciple of Jesus Christ in a way that he hadn't quite been before.
Can you describe how that process developed, and what was the practical impact of that move?
The main thing is that here he is in New York City. Now, I live in New York City with my wife and daughter, and New York is a famously secular place. And he goes to Union Theological Seminary, and what he sees there passing for theology, in his words, was a little bit depressing. He'd been used to great theologians at Berlin University, and this was really not something that he was impressed with. But it seems pretty clear pretty quickly that the reason he's in New York has little to do with these studies at Union Theological Seminary, because what happens is a fellow student, an African-American student named Frank Fisher from Alabama, invites him up to Harlem to visit Abyssinian Baptist Church, which is obviously a huge African-American church. And Bonhoeffer is absolutely bowled over by what he experiences that Sunday morning. He's never seen worship like this, never heard music like this, never seen a suffering congregation, thousands of people. I think it was literally the largest congregation in America at the time. And he saw people who were not playing at religion. They weren't merely churchgoers. They were people who seemed transfixed by Jesus, changed by him, and the messages from the pulpit were fiery gospel sermons. This was not like anything he was experiencing in any of the white churches in Germany or in New York. And so it really moved him, and he decides to go back to this African-American church every Sunday morning, which he does. He gets involved in the congregation's lives. He teaches Sunday school. This really changes things, and when he goes back to Germany, people can see that he's much more serious about his faith. He's not just a brilliant theologian obsessed with impressing the world with his academic abilities, but rather a disciple of Jesus Christ. He seems to take God much more seriously. And, of course, the Nazis are rising, so there's this inevitable clash between this changed Bonhoeffer and this changed Germany, where people are turning toward Hitler and the Nazis.
Yes. He'd been raised not to resist the powers that be, the government, the authorities of the day, but that is overturned in his mind by his unfolding approach to evil. How did he particularly view what the Nazis were doing to Germany, in Germany and beyond, that brought him to categorize their actions as evil?
For one thing, Bonhoeffer is very rare in seeing way up front that the Nazis are not just not Christians, but they are bitterly and passionately anti-Christian. They despised true Christianity and despised true believers in Jesus Christ. They were willing to play patty cake with the church because the church was, in many ways, an institution where many people didn't really know what they believed. And as long as the church could be manipulated, Hitler would play the game of being a Christian, and he would instruct his top lieutenants, Goebbels and Goering and all of them, to pretend to be Christian, not to be openly at war with the church, because they needed this to maintain and augment their political power.
Yes.
Bonhoeffer saw, though, that this was a ruse and that they were instituting many, that the Nazis were instituting many programs and laws which were clearly against the gospel. And Bonhoeffer saw, first of all, the Nazi prohibition that Jews who had accepted Christ could be members of the German church. Bonhoeffer immediately said, wait a minute, this is the church. God looks on the heart. He doesn't look on your bloodline. He doesn't say you have Jewish blood, so you cannot be part of the church. The church is the place where everyone can be. And Bonhoeffer saw right there that this is a battle line that we must fight on this line. If the church cannot be the church now over this racial issue, the church is dead. And so he was trying to wake up the church in Germany. This was only the beginning. It went on and on and on from there. You can imagine the Nazis moved forward with ruthless speed, just crushing their opposition in every direction. Bonhoeffer was in the middle of the fray, mainly for the church, but then, of course, it went beyond that, and he realized that he had to be more active in the actual resistance against Adolf Hitler.
And he was. On Open House, we're with Eric Metaxas, author of Bonhoeffer, Pastor, Martyr, Prophet, Spy. Eric, can you take us through the circumstances in which Bonhoeffer came to be involved actively in plans to overthrow, ultimately kill Hitler?
Well, his resistance to the Nazis keeps taking different forms. You see that Bonhoeffer is constantly praying and asking the Lord to guide him. He didn't just have a one-size-fits-all idea that I must do this or I must do this. So his resistance continues to change throughout the 1930s. He becomes more deceptive with the Nazis. He takes the seminary training that he's doing, illegal seminary training. Obviously, this is all in the book, but he at some point takes this underground, and he's more and more deceiving them. But then the war comes, and he realizes that he cannot fight in Hitler's war. In other words, at this point, he's going to have to make a decision because he knows that he will not be able to fight in Hitler's war. He's not a pacifist in the traditional sense, in the sense that we might think today, but he knew that he cannot fight in Hitler's war, that it was a war of aggression, that it was nationalism run amok. And he's wondering, what can I do? What will I do? I'm not simply going to declare myself as against the war. What should I do? And so at one point in 1939, he decides to go back to America. Of course, he'd been there in 1930 and 31, as I just said. But now, after all these years in the 30s have passed, and he decides, as the war comes, to go back to America, in a sense, to escape what is coming, because he could not pick up a rifle and fight in this war. And he gets on a ship, and many people pulled strings so that he could escape. Reinhold Niebuhr, most famously, wrote many letters so that people would invite Bonhoeffer, and he would have a way of legitimately leaving Germany. And he does this, gets on the ship, and no sooner is he crossing the Atlantic than he realizes he's made a mistake. He understands that somehow he doesn't have the peace of God, and continues to pray, asking the Lord to lead him. And every day he's reading the scriptures. He would read these Moravian texts every day, a little scripture verse, and pray and say, Lord, speak to me through these verses. Speak to me through your word. Show me what to do. Well, when he gets off in America, he's still puzzling over what course of action to take, but every day that passes, he's surer and surer that he cannot stay very long in America. He was first going to stay 3 years, then a year. It ends up that he stays exactly 26 days. He goes, gets on a ship 26 days after he's arrived in New York, gets on a ship in New York Harbor, and in early July of 1939, sails back into what is obviously danger. And the question, of course, is what exactly is he going to do when he gets there? His friends are astounded that he's there when they see him. What are you doing here? We did everything to get you out of here. You're brilliant. You know, you have this wonderful future, and what's going to happen? And, well, what he did now is where it really gets sort of crazy. Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law was a leading member in the conspiracy against Adolf Hitler. He was a member of the Abwehr, that's the German military intelligence. And Bonhoeffer decides at this point, in a sense, to save face, to make it look like he's serving the aims of the Third Reich during wartime. He joins the Abwehr. His brother-in-law hires him to work for German military intelligence, to use his considerable talents traveling around Europe, ostensibly to further the aims of the Third Reich. But in fact, what he's really doing is he's now joining the top conspirators who were in military intelligence to undermine the Nazis and, in fact, to assassinate Hitler and his top lieutenant. So at this point, Bonhoeffer is traveling around Europe to make secret contact with members of the Allies, with the Churchill government, most notably Anthony Eden, to let Anthony Eden and Churchill know that there are Germans inside Germany who are working for the defeat of Adolf Hitler. It's an extraordinary thing, but he is now a double agent, in fact a spy, even as he looks like he's, you know, being a good Nazi.
And he was quite able to justify that in his own mind, intellectually, theologically, embracing that within his Christian worldview.
Yes, it's quite complicated, and yet I think Bonhoeffer, one of the reasons I think the book has struck such a chord and so many people are talking about it is because he challenges us all to think more deeply, much in the way Jesus does. Jesus says, you've heard it said X. Well, I say unto you, you know, X plus Y. You have to think much more deeply than having these simple religious slogans about this is right and this is wrong. I mean, we can say, okay, killing is wrong. Thou shalt not murder. Well, is it that simple? We don't say that David repented of murdering Goliath. We cheer. Well, what is it about that that's different from the way he treated Uriah the Hittite? When is something murder and when is something justified killing to save innocent life? It's very interesting to see that Bonhoeffer dealing with the evil of the Nazis forces us to look more deeply at these questions and even just at the question of when is it okay to deceive someone? I mean, the scripture says, thou shalt not lie, but you have examples in the scripture where you have spies and you have Rahab, and you have different things going on. And Bonhoeffer, he's in the midst of this evil, so he cannot be merely religious. He cannot have easy religious slogans, bromides. He has to really think, what is the will of the Lord? What is the Lord calling me to do? And ultimately, he does believe that the Lord has called him to be part of this conspiracy to kill Hitler, to save Germany, to save the Jews of Germany. It's very interesting and compelling, and I think, again, that's one of the reasons that it's such an inspiring story and so many people have been interested in the book, that it really forces us to think more deeply about the lives that we're living right now and how we would react had we been alive in Bonhoeffer's time.
One of the many significant things you examine is the role and the place of the church in Germany at the time, as the Nazis were in a way redefining Christianity and ultimately humanity. For instance, that the German Jew was no longer human.
Yeah, this is what's so interesting, as I say, about Bonhoeffer, is that he's doing this intellectual heavy lifting. He's thinking these things through from a completely biblical point of view, whereas many in the church were not doing that. Many in the church were, to use the phrase, merely religious. They had easy answers, easy religious answers, but Bonhoeffer's saying, what is the mind of the Lord? What is the scriptural idea, not just our easy answer? And, of course, the easy religious answer is often entirely wrong. It's pharisaical and moralistic, and we're supposed to have the mind of Christ. We're supposed to think more deeply. Bonhoeffer really was calling the church to do that, and that's why the title of the book is it's Bonhoeffer, Pastor, Martyr, Prophet, Spy, because there's a prophetic element that he's calling the people of God to be the people of God. He's calling the church to be the church when they really weren't doing that. That's what the prophets have always done, and that's why I really think that his voice was the voice of a prophet.
And ultimately, his secret activities plotting the downfall of the Third Reich and the death of Hitler are found out, and he's arrested.
Yes. He was arrested before they found that out. He was arrested in 1943. He'd just gotten engaged, and I tell the story of his love affair and engagement really for the first time ever. I didn't expect to tell any really new stories, but there are a number of things in the book that are quite new, and this love affair and this engagement have never really been told properly before. And so at the end, just as he gets engaged, he is arrested by the Nazis for his involvement in a plot to get 7 Jews out of Germany and into neutral Switzerland to save their lives. And he's arrested for that. So he's not arrested for his involvement in a plot to kill Hitler. Mm. He's quite sure that he can win his case and fool the prosecutor, and he can get out and get married. And so they're planning to be married. There are all these letters, and I quote many of the letters between Bonhoeffer and his fiancée, because they're really quite sure that he will get out, or he's thinking that he'll get out because the plotters, who are in fact still conspiring to kill Hitler, will succeed and things will end that way, or the Allies will defeat the Nazis and the war will end that way. So he's quite hopeful to get out, but of course what happens is one of the plots to kill Hitler, one of the attempts, I should say, the Valkyrie plot, goes awry. It doesn't just fail to kill Hitler, but it also exposes the conspiracy, and that's the moment, July 20th, 1944, when Bonhoeffer's days are numbered, because now thousands are arrested and tortured, the conspiracy's been exposed, and one of the names at the top of the list is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So from here on in, he's not just seen as someone who was involved in a plot to get some Jews out of Germany, but he's somebody who tried to have the Führer assassinated, and so he only survives from that point on into the spring, April of 1945, and he's executed at dawn on April 9th in Flossenbürg concentration camp.
Take us through those final days of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. This is in a Nazi concentration camp.
Yeah, well, actually, he was not quite in a concentration camp, but this is one of the joys of writing this book, is to see how many things I had misunderstood, and I wanted to set them right in the book. One of those is that Bonhoeffer was first in Tegel Military Prison, which was not very bad as prisons go, when he was being held for his involvement in the plot to get the 7 Jews out of Germany. Then when the Valkyrie plot goes awry, he is finally transferred to the Gestapo prison. The Gestapo prison, of course, was a terrible place. Then he's transferred to some barracks just on the edge of Buchenwald. So he's not really in the camp. He's being held with a number of high-level prisoners who are probably being thought of as future bargaining chips when the Nazis lose the war. And so these are terrible places, but it's not quite a concentration camp. And then the last week of his life, for me, it's my favorite part of the book. It's a dreamy, in some ways strangely beautiful period where he's traveling in a van with a number of soldiers, guards are taking him and these high-level prisoners, trying to find a place to put them because the Allies are bombing and bombing. And so he's traveling in one of the people that he's traveling with is a Nazi doctor who invented the gas chambers. It's just spectacularly strange information that I uncovered that's never really been written about.
Yes.
Before. And finally, on April 8th, Bonhoeffer has preached a sermon for his fellow prisoners. He's in a being kept in a little school, in a schoolhouse in Bavaria, and he is suddenly summoned. He's preached a sermon and conducted a service for his fellow prisoners, and he's summoned to go with these men, and they take him to Flossenbürg concentration camp, where there's an overnight drum court trial, and at dawn he's executed. But it's a very, very strange and in some ways strangely beautiful final week of his life.
Why then? Why was he executed then?
He was executed on the express orders of Hitler, who simply wanted revenge on the men who had plotted to kill him. You can imagine Hitler in his miserable bunker realizing that he's not getting out alive, realizing that his dream of a thousand-year Reich is coming to an end, and thinking in his petty way of the men who worked against him, probably thinking that if it hadn't been for their efforts and efforts of people like them, that he would have succeeded. So he was finally a very petty, vengeful man, and he simply had Bonhoeffer and a few others killed because he wanted them killed, not because he thought that he could succeed at that point.
And within days, he and the Third Reich are gone. World War II is over.
3 weeks later, he takes his own life, and the Allies win, yes.
Yeah. Such stunning timing. You can only say that, such stunning timing.
Oh, it is. And I remember hearing, I travel widely speaking about Bonhoeffer, and I end my talks by usually saying that, you know, our instinct is to simply think that this is tragic. If only he could have wriggled free to die right at the end of the war, to be engaged, to be 39, to be brilliant, and then just as the war is ending, if only he could have lived a few more weeks. But I think Bonhoeffer would be the first to rebuke us and to say, no, I was being obedient to the Lord, and I was walking in obedience to him in all of this. And he really believed that and meant to live that way. And then if that led him to the gallows, that was the Lord's will, and praise the Lord. That's he really had a deep faith, and I think that's why this story is so inspiring, because it inspires us to have that kind of a faith, to live that way without a fear of death, knowing that God has conquered death. And that's really at the heart of why he is so fascinating, so compelling. He's authentic, and he is a deeply, deeply faithful Christian. It's hard not to be impressed by his faith.
I want to ask you about the lessons of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life in two categories. First, as it concerns the church's role in society, and secondly, as it relates to us personally. What are we to learn? What are we to gain from this enormously significant figure?
Well, regarding the church's role in society, Bonhoeffer makes it clear, and I think Wilberforce in my previous biography, Amazing Grace, both of these figures make it clear that Christians must neither avoid politics nor must we make an idol of politics. God calls us into this dirty world to bring the gospel, to bring salt and light into it. And Bonhoeffer is living in a dirty time, an evil time, but he's saying to the church, you must stand up. You must perceive what God is saying, and you must do what God is calling you to do. You're God's hands in the world. If you don't do it, it won't happen. It won't get done, and evil will prevail. Bonhoeffer was calling the church to wake up. I think of this now in America. We have, attacks on our religious freedom. Now is the time for the church to stand up and to say, no, the role of the church is this, the role of the state is this, and we won't abide this. Bonhoeffer was trying to get the church to do that in his day and saying that we have the ability to win if we will fight, if we will recognize what the church's role is to protect the minority, for example, in this case, the Jews. But to stand up for what is right, not just for what helps us personally, but to stand up for what is right, to do what is right, to fight when necessary, and to fight God's way, not our own way, but to fight nonetheless. I think that's Wilberforce's lesson as well. Bonhoeffer's voice, as I said, is prophetic, and he's telling the church, you must be the church. It's no different than Isaiah or Jeremiah or anybody saying to the people of God, you've got to be the people of God. You've got to be holy and set apart, and you've got to do what God calls you to do, or you will be judged. And that's precisely what happened in Bonhoeffer's day. I think that with regard to how we can live our lives personally, Bonhoeffer shows us, I think, that we can live our lives with profound courage, that if we really believe what we claim to believe, and this is very important to Bonhoeffer, the idea that we know what we believe, we don't hope, we know this is true, and we will stand for the truth. And it gives us a courage, it gives us a boldness, coupled with the humility of knowing that we're sinners saved by grace. Somehow, for me, Bonhoeffer is the ultimate model, at least when I think of what's in front of me. I think of him as somebody that God has given us as a model of what it's like to be fully human. What is God's idea of a fully redeemed human being, someone who enjoys music and art and laughter and sports and who couldn't be more serious about God, all rolled into one. It's a beautiful, beautiful picture, and as I say, I think it's somehow very inspiring and ultimately very encouraging because we need that encouragement as believers. It's not easy, and in the world in which we live, we need models. We need to see how has he done it. So it just makes me happy to be able to bring his story before the world at this point.
Glad you have. At the end of it all, Eric, this grand project of yours, how were you left personally by it all, in addition to being just relieved? How are you personally shaped by Bonhoeffer's life and death?
I think in a way it made me realize that time is short, that a lot of times I think we might think that someday I will stand up and speak out, someday. And I think Bonhoeffer is God's way of saying, you must do that now. You must be living fully now. Do not shrink from what God calls you to speak. Speak the truth in love, but speak the truth. I was just had the huge privilege and honor of being the keynote speaker at the American National Prayer Breakfast, and President Obama was there, and it was a huge honor for me. And in the course of speaking to this assembled 4,000 people, and the President and First Lady, and Vice President, and so on and so forth, I said a few words about the unborn, about a biblical view of sexuality, but I pray that I said it in a way that showed the love of Jesus, that if we don't speak the truth in love, we're not speaking the truth, that the Lord always wants us to speak the truth in love. And I think that there's something about Bonhoeffer that helped me to see that we must do that now. We must, if everyone would do that, as Bonhoeffer was exhorting the church in his day, if everyone would simply stand up, the fight would not be so terrible. But it's when most don't speak up. So we've got to understand that God calls each of us to speak up individually, and that's just I think what happened to me. I wasn't a shrinking violet, but I think that something about this story of this brave man galvanized me to be bolder, hopefully in a humble way, but bolder nonetheless to speak the truth.
You've certainly conveyed that powerfully, both in the book and during the last half hour that we've been spending with you. Eric Metaxas, so grateful for your time. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on Open House.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thanks ever so much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.